Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Hello there and welcome back to another electrifying episode of This Song Is Yours. I'm your host, Simon Fink, and today we have a true legend on the podcast with us. Joining us is none other than the esteemed Australian songwriter, Mark Seymour. With a storied career spanning decades, Mark has left an indelible mark on the music world through his iconic work with Hunters and Collectors and his acclaimed solo ventures. Today marks a momentous occasion as Mark and his band, The Undertow, unleash their latest musical offering upon the world. It is The Boxer. An album that is brimming with poignant storytelling and soul-stirring melodies, The Boxer is a testament to Mark's enduring artistry and unparalleled songwriting prowess. Exploring themes of despair, urban decay, love, and the quest for self-discovery, this record is a captivating journey through the human experience. From the hauntingly beautiful ballads to the anthemic rockers, The Boxer offers a sonic landscape that resonates deeply with listeners. Now, in today's conversation, we have the privilege of delving into the heart and soul of Mark Seymour and this latest masterpiece. We'll uncover the stories behind the songs, the trials and triumphs that inspired its creation, and the artistic evolution that continues to define Mark's musical journey. We'll also take a trip down memory lane as Mark reflects on his time with Hunters and Collectors, sharing insights into the band's enduring legacy and the impact of their iconic music on generations of fans. And folks, get ready for a special treat as Mark reveals the musical gems currently gracing his playlist, including the captivating sounds of Phoebe Bridges, courtesy of his daughter's impeccable taste in music. Now, before we kick off this unforgettable conversation, I want to extend a heartfelt thank you to Julia for her invaluable assistance in bringing today's episode to life. And please remember to check out today's episode show notes. You'll be able to find where you can purchase and stream The Boxer, and you'll also be able to find all of our social media channels. Everything's down there. You'll find it in today's show notes. So let's dive deep into the sonic realm of The Boxer with the one and only Mark Seymour.
There's a right time and there's a wrong. I've been guilty of coming along too strong.
I tried to. Please welcome to This Song Is Yours, Mark Seymour. Mark, hello. How are you doing?
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much indeed.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's very exciting. There's a brand new record out for yourself and The Undertow. So firstly, congratulations on this incredible new record, The Boxer.
Thank you. I'm pretty excited about it. It's been a while. Last year. It takes so long to launch albums these days, but I think there's, because it's so many platforms that the record company grapples with, you know, in prep, in advance. But we'll be hitting the road in a little while, and it's the creature has been born. So yeah,
it is an incredibly exciting time with all those kind of things going on. One thing you just mentioned then, I know that I recognise your name through the history of Australian music, and I think many Australian listeners would be. For those international listeners, I can't speak to that. But you're not new to releasing music. As you said, this is there's so much to kind of do and get ready in terms of prep for releasing a record these days. You've been releasing records for the last 3 to 4 decades or so. Like, does the excitement still run the same? Do you get nervous when it comes to releasing a brand new batch of songs?
I think, look, it's songwriting is, it's all about songwriting. Like the whole object, aim of the game is to write songs. That's what I was put here to do. And the older I get, the more clear that is in my mind that that's what I really love doing. And fortunately, I mean, my stage craft has improved a lot. My vocal capacity is, strangely, has gotten better as I've gotten older. So the bits are all there, you know, but the thing is, I never struggle to, if someone comes to me and says, how about making a record, Mark? And I'm always up for it, you know, like I need someone to kind of throw that switch and I'll go, all right, okay, well, let's just look at this, you know. And so that hasn't changed. Like when I started in 81, the idea of writing a song was really important to me. Like I'd just come out of uni, you know, I was playing with a bunch of friends and the goal was to create new interesting stories that you could sing, and that has never changed. And my process is the same. You know, I just ruminate on the couch. You know, I've got the guitar there, and I mean, the technology has, you know, gone through massive upheaval in the last 20 years. But it always amazes me just how different you when you finally come back into kind of rubbing shoulders with the record company and like watching the methods that they've deployed, and you know, they've tried all these things out in between my records, which, you know, come out every sort of 3 years or so. You know, they're off with other artists and developing their marketing strategies, and then you come back into the room and, oh, they're doing it like that now. You know, there's a sort of a new kind of way of marketing records. And, you know, I think one of the things I've really, and it's a theme I've really explored quite deeply on this record, is this question of character and the capacity to adapt and be resilient in the face of life's challenges. And I've come back to writing a very, very personal record. And, you know, I've realised that back in the day when I was with Hunters and Collectors, and there was this sort of broader sense of the importance of trying to write big stories and talk to society, and, you know, Hunters and Collectors had this kind of idea of itself as being sort of a almost like a prog type attitude of you don't get too personal, and you don't, you know, the idea of expressing yourself in song from a personal position and seeing where you are in the world as a starting point, no matter how far out you look, that the idea of being too personal was almost a sign of weakness. And I don't know whether that was a masculine preoccupation or whether it was just the cultural yearnings of some of those guys. The irony was, when I finished this album, The Boxer, I actually realised that the songs that have become most famous in that era from that group were very personal songs. You know, they were always written, you know, they were in character. I might find a character, but I always was writing from the idea of being struggle, you know, like some kind of emotional struggle. And I think that's always been my starting point, really. And in that many ways, this album is no exception. But I think because I'd come through an enormous shift in my life as a middle-aged man, coming out of a 29-year marriage to my lovely wife, Jo, that came to an end. My children left home. I moved back into the city. I now live in a very small apartment in Fitzroy. It's great. and I've discovered boxing, and a whole lot of things shifted. And when the record company came to me and said, should you think about making a record? It's about time. I kind of thought, well, I kind of don't have any songs, you know. But then I thought, I certainly have raw material. And so it really, I turned it around really quickly. It didn't take long at all to make this record. And the band is very highly evolved now. I mean, we've been together now for almost 9 years. And, you know, there's all these rabbit holes we just don't go down anymore. Like, everything's fast. You know, we just react to each other very quickly, which is a sign of a mature, hardworking band. I mean, my career's always been built around touring, that's for sure.
100%. This record is stunning in terms of its, as you just kind of said, it is a deeply personal record. There was a massive kind of time of upheaval, change. I know you just kind of went into some of those items just then. How did you find as a songwriter? And it's interesting that you said in the Hunters days that there was only like a few kind of songs that were deeply personal, that it was meant to be on a more of a broad spectrum, because I think a lot of people would find, or a lot of fans would say, that Hunter songs are actually quite deeply personal. Maybe it's deeply personal to them and it has that connection. How did you approach writing some of these songs that obviously had such raw subject matter and material, but not overshare them or not kind of lay them out bare? You obviously still want to keep some of your own privacy and your own thoughts in relation to those. How did you kind of balance that kind of act?
The thing is, going back to Hunters and Collectors for a moment, I think the trick in that group of I'm not sure now, looking back, that whether the guys as a group were that conscious of how deeply personal some of that stuff was, like that I was bringing things into the room that I was experiencing, you know, 100% myself. I mean, I wasn't kind of the lyrical source wasn't something that was coming from shared feeling. It was coming from what my life was doing. And I was bringing, but the attitude in the room was that, oh, well, that's what he does. That's his particular skill set. So let's just see how that will work to that and just see what we come up with. They weren't approaching it from the idea of relating to me personally. Mm. And I think that's kind of how a lot of bands operate, you know, especially if they're all male. They don't necessarily relate specifically to what I'm doing. The empathy's not on the table. You know, and so I kind of took that for granted as a way of operating, until years later when I thought, you know what, like especially after the band sort of went into retirement, I just realised that a lot of the songs that I've kept, or all of them actually, have come from that personal position, and that's kind of defined everything I've done ever since. You know, like it's tracking. Rather than looking sideways or looking out first, I'd go, well, I now go, look, here I am, what am I doing? You know, it sounds really quite prosaic, but it's very difficult to get it right. But when you do, punters really relate to it. And that's the name of the game. Like, you walk into a room, you don't know who these people are, they're all standing there, paid money, they're there to listen, and they're looking for a clue in the song for a place that they can put themselves. And that's the whole point of live music, you know, that songs are there to provide create a sense of community for however long that is, an hour and a half, whatever. That's why people front up, you know. I'm very, very respectful of that, you know, and I've become more and more aware of that as I've gotten older. Do you want to ask a question? Because I could talk about that for hours.
No. Please go ahead.
Well, it's just interesting that slightly detached attitude that Hunters had, I think, had something to do with the kind of working environment we're in as well. Like those pubs, you know, and I've talked to people from that era. I mean, a lot of my old friends in other bands come from that era, where people would be packed into the rooms. And nobody knew what capacity was, you know, like the idea of the pub gig where it was actually potentially physically dangerous, you know. There was always a feeling of, not always, but often there was a feeling, particularly as we got into the early 90s, that there was something we're on the brink of something really quite heavy, you know, that the live performance environment was kind of threatening. You know, because it was so physical and everyone's squashed in tight, drinking alcohol, you know, there's mosh, people surging from left to right. You know, I saw the video of, I don't know if you've seen it, Woodstock 99 on Netflix. That kind of was the end of a particular era in music where that kind of incredibly intense surging in crowds. I mean, it never quite got to that point, but the pub thing definitely had the potential to, you know, go awry physically. And I think that kind of affected the way we played our music. Like, rather than sort of trying to create a sense of intimacy. I mean, you could still rock your socks off, but bringing things down to a point where you could really hear a pin drop, you just couldn't do that in that environment. So that kind of informed my songwriting for a while. I went, okay, well, those sort of songs, are they appropriate or not, you know, because there's like – and so you'd get to Throw Your Arms Around Me and – oh, my God, you'd go, that's such a relief. We're now playing Throw Your Arms Around Me. Everybody can calm down, you know.
Yeah.
And it was always a still point. And I think that's part of the reason why that song – well, I mean, there's a lot of structural reasons why it endured, but it certainly was very – and still is a very important song for me because it's kind of held things together, you know.
100%. I think that there's – And I do want to talk about the new album in a second, but well, because it's kind of come up organically, I did want to talk about, I guess, the how songs resonate, and especially as you just said, "Throw Your Arms Around Me" has one of the longest set of legs that I've seen on a song in terms of its enduring kind of nature. You've had people from Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam to Ed Sheeran to Neil Finn cover this song or resonate with it. When you're putting out music, and it could be from Hunter's Days, it could be from any of your kind of solo records, can you tell when a song has a certain staying power or when it kind of has that magic in it that you can see or be able to recognize that it's going to resonate with fans in a certain way?
Well, if I sit down, if I start writing and I get a feeling that I'm writing a ballad, if it starts to have that feeling, it's usually pretty obvious early on, oh, okay, this is going to be a ballad, you know. Mm. You know, and it's tempo and just tone and the kind of melody I'm choosing, how, you know, it doesn't necessarily, like the weird thing is I could be writing the subject, it's not actually necessarily about the subject, it's oddly enough. I mean, ballads just have they're like a life force in music. They have a certain resonance and a feeling that you identify early on. But I think with Throw Your Arms Around Me, it's just out of the park. It's quite separate. I mean, it's accidental, you know. I mean, I write ballads. There's a song on my new album called Waiting on the Kid, and it definitely has that quality. Mm. But I don't know. It's good. I really love it, you know, but it's very specific. It's like a really specific narrative, whereas Throw Your Arms Around Me, because I think it brings together desire, like sexual desire, and then real personal yearning and the need for transcendence all in one song. And it's for that reason, it's incredibly fragile. And then it's also become an anthem, so because of the way that chorus rises. But it's quite weird. Like there's a huge randomness in that song, which I had no concept that it would be, and Hunters and Collectors certainly didn't either. Like certainly didn't. Like, we recorded it in so many different ways, and you know, sort of fucked it up like two or three times until the record company came and said, "Guys, you got to get this right," you know, and even then, like it's, you know, now you know when I'm walking through Coles buying frozen peas, the one that comes up on Coles radio is this really old one, like that's really fragile and weird and indie sounding, and that was the one that radio rejected. Like, so even though the band tried to make a version that sounded kind of a bit, had a bit of authority and smoothness, that's not the one that ended up being what got played, you know.
Which that's is so funny.
It got rejected when it was first released, you know, like, so it's weird. Yeah.
That's so, so funny. I know you just mentioned Waiting on the Kid. On this new album, it features Linda Bull, the incredible track, gorgeous kind of track. How did Linda get involved in the track?
Well, I've been spending quite a bit of time with Linda. She has... would go last year, her daughter was in final year high school, and I'd talk to her over the phone. She'd be like, "Where are you?" "Oh, I'm waiting on the kid." And she'd be outside the school gate or parked nearby the school. And it was the kid, her daughter, her final year at school. And I just found that idea of a single mum. There's quite a bit of that on this record, the idea of relating my own personal alienation and struggle with the women's stories. And she actually said to me, and the box is one of them as well. The box is a woman's story. It's me describing a woman doing something, and that her, and I related to that really quite deeply, like, because I'd been through that stage much earlier because my daughters are much older. But waiting at the school gate, I just, and it really struck me. I had this really powerful melancholic feeling about the devotion you have for your children, you know, regardless of whatever else is going on in your life. And she talked about that, you know. So we knocked that up together, you know. I started fleshing out the state of mind you have when you look back and how much commitment you've had for that child, and it is sort of distilled in the line waiting on the kid. And she refers to her child as the kid as well, which I found quite unusual. Like, I've never referred to my children as kids. Some people do that, you know, and it's a beautiful word. It's very folky, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's a gorgeous track, and both you and Linda, it sonically sounds incredible. And one thing you kind of touched on at the start of the art interview today was the fact that you've found, one, your songwriting chops kind of continue to improve, but also your voice, your performance chops seem to be getting better as well. There was one track on here where I was just not blown away. You're a very impressive musician and it should be acknowledged so.
Thank you.
But my favorite track, of course, my favorite track on the record was Cherry Red. And I was just super impressed. I came back time and time again because your vocals on this, it just, after so many years of hearing people sing, there's this somewhat common occurrence where you'll hear people's voice deteriorate or whatever it may be the case. And for you, that is not the situation for Cherry Red and for this record.
Yeah, it's quite high. It's high and clear, right? There's no gravel in it. Well, there's a little bit, but it's the thing about that song, I mean, it's probably my favourite song on the record. It's about barreling up the Calder Highway to Mildura, oddly, you know, and hitting Witcherproof, and there's this, the Mallee, and I did this journey a couple of times because my sister lives up on the Murray, and after I'd separated from my wife, and, you know, this whole feeling of, you know, what the fuck has happened? My life is, I mean, the idea of going through, of being married for as long as I was, and all of those images of the big W and the dog park and, you know, 7-Eleven and loading your boot full of plunder in the car park outside the shopping centre, all that stuff, it's deliberately constructed to try and create the feeling of the suburbs, you know, the feeling of living in the suburb where everything's at your fingertips. You have everything you could possibly need to live and survive. Very comfortable, very middle class, and it all comes apart. Because people are feelings affect everything. And I having all of this reflection as I'm heading up the Calder, and I see this sunset outside Witcherproof. And I just went, man, this is, I'm free, you know? Just right now, it was, I don't know, when they talk about, Americans talk about the pursuit of happiness. I don't think you pursue happiness. We have this myth in the West of the idea that it's something that you can achieve and attain. And then it's there and you are in that state. But that's not how it works. Life is, happiness just comes and goes. It's like this moment when you, it's a state, it's a feeling. And you're in it and then it disappears. And it's part of life, you know. And I think that there's the mythology about, you know, being born again or finding your, you know, the idea of transcendence and reaching a point where everything's resolved. It's just bullshit Western mythology. Life isn't like that. And I've come through this process in midlife where I've gone, you know what? That's bullshit, you know? And that song, what that does is it distills the moment when you go, wow, this is life. And
it really does.
It's the favourite song on the record because it's incredibly positive. You know, it describes all of this dysfunction and mediocrity, and then you hit the sunset and like, wow, you know, it's just very, very, that'll end up being, you know, I've always found that there are songs on every record which people kind of go, oh, yeah, that's all right, not bad. And then, you know, like Holy Grail's one of them, obviously, you know, people went, oh, yeah, whatever. Like the band Hunters didn't want to put that on the record. And the producer said, it doesn't have a chorus. And Cherry Red's kind of like that. It's sort of buried in the album. And it's, you know, it sounds like a climbing melodic rock song, but that'll end up being a big live song, no question. People will really want, it's just got this feeling about it, you know.
I would 100% agree with that. It was, I think, yeah, as I said, my favourite track on the record. So thank you for kind of indulging and explaining to us, because it's, yeah, gorgeous, gorgeous track. Speaking of, I guess, taking these songs into a live setting, you are hitting the road for the next few months, I think. There's dates throughout April, May and June in support of Boxer. How are you, obviously with such a prolific career and so many kind of albums behind you, how do you work out what makes it onto the set list from this new record, and then what kind of sits amongst the classics?
Well, it's not easy. I mean, it depends on – we've got some shows with Cameron Bruce. He's an extraordinary keyboard player, plays in some very famous Australian artists. Got him for a few shows. So when he's on deck, we will do most of the record. But – because the sets will be longer. But I don't know, like I'm sort of working on that now. I mean, we do so many different types of shows. Like we're doing a set of Chris Isaak gigs, so that'll be an hour. So we're going to kind of have to tail the show to accommodate that type of gig. Look, I reckon I'll get half the album into the set on a permanent basis. But, I mean, we've got... It's a long... We've got a lot of shit songs, you know? And, yeah, just depends, really.
Of course. Is there... I know we just talked about Cherry Red, but is there any other tracks that you're kind of looking forward to giving a bit of a live debut, one that you're hoping really resonates with audiences in a live setting?
Well, probably All My Rage, which is the second track, I think. And, I mean, the box is already in there. Next one, Stars of Fitzroy will go in for the Chris Isaak show. So Cherry Red, Stars of Fitzroy, Boxer. But I'm actually thinking about putting in She Burned Her Bridges Down as well.
Mm-hmm. Great track.
I really love that song. Yeah.
That's another fantastic track. And, again, just super impressive in terms of the strength of your voice and the register in which you're kind of cover in that track and in Cherry Red as well. So no, I know that there's a lot of people excited about these live shows. So we'll make sure that all details are in the podcast show notes for people to buy tickets, see where you're touring, see where when you're coming to a town near them.
The governor Hindmarsh.
That's the one for us, exactly.
People into the Governor Hindmarsh. Yeah.
We'll be there at that one. So all details, I think, yeah, you're covering quite a bit of ground. You're going to quite a few cities and towns, and so yeah, it's very impressive. Yeah. Mark, we'd usually ask our guests what they're currently listening to. Is there anything at the moment that kind of is on high rotation for yourself?
Phoebe Bridges. Mm-hmm. I keep coming back to Phoebe Bridges. Look, there were a bunch of artists that I was listening to when I moved here. Jason Isbell. Mm-hmm. Bonnie Raitt. I've just suddenly discovered Bonnie Raitt. And, of course, John Prine, God rest his soul. A lot of people were into John Prine for years and I didn't know who the hell he was. And I've ended up covering a John Prine song at the end of the album, which it's a beautiful song about his wife. And it's fun. It's sadly funny, which and I love. His turn of phrase is exquisite. That's in there. Yeah.
Does have a way with words, Mr. Prine. I'm very curious for you, how do you come across new music? I wasn't expecting to say someone like Miss Phoebe Bridges, so I'm curious, how do you come across new music?
Well, that one was my daughter, Hannah. She was listening to Phoebe Bridges just before she left, went overseas. She was living with me when I moved here. She was shacked up for about 6 weeks before she went overseas. And she just had a bunch of girl singers on rotation in the flat, and I just got immersed in it, you know. Yeah. What's the – there's an all-girl group that – quite big that Phoebe Bridgers did a song on. Is it Moona?
Yes, yeah.
And that album, it started with Moona. But, see, that's kind of – I just hear things, you know. It's just passing tunes. I mean, I always react to melody, I suppose. And melody and the tone of a person's voice, like I relate to the way a person sings, attracts me. I'm looking for sort of a strength and vulnerability and character, you know. And it's pretty kind of subtle, really. I don't really have an issue with old music at all, you know. I often find someone like Bonnie Raitt. I mean, I never kind of thought about Bonnie Raitt when I was a little punk, you know. But a lot of music's come to me from that era that I overlooked. That's really resonates with me now, you know.
It is funny. We've spoken to a lot of people recently who have kind of just stumbled or come across things that, for whatever reason, they missed the first time round. And it is funny how if songwriting, the foundations are strong enough, that they will just stand the test of time. And at some point, you'll kind of come across them or find what is your avenue into that artist's music or songwriting.
I think Casey Chambers is really underrated. Like, I've been hearing stuff, some of her recent work that's just fantastic. You know, she's an incredibly good lyricist. And yet she's kind of never, no one ever really, I mean, I know she's celebrated and she's very successful, but, you know, in terms of the, you know, who's in the pantheon of great Australian songwriters, and people just don't mention her, you know, and yet she's incredibly gifted. Like, she's a very good songwriter. So I kind of rate her big time, you know.
100%. Yeah. I would agree with that. I think that there's definitely a stage somewhere in the mid-2000s, late 2000s, where we celebrated her quite a lot, and then she's still been putting out incredible records, but it just kind of, as you said, that acknowledgement kind of falls along the wayside for whatever reason. So, no, I agree 100% with that in terms of Casey Chambers and some of those other artists that you mentioned as well, like Bonnie Raitt and Phoebe Bridgers. Absolutely love Phoebe Bridgers here at the podcast, so fantastic choice. If you could... And it might be a little bit unfair. You could pick one track that you are from Phoebe Bridgers. What would you kind of shout out, or what would you tell people to listen to?
Put up Scott Street.
Oh, classic. Great choice.
Scott Street, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic choice. Mark, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. I do appreciate you coming on and having a chat. The album is The Boxer by Mark Seymour and The Undertow. It is out today, when you're listening to this podcast. But yeah, Mark, thank you again for coming onto the podcast and having a chat.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.